Second Vice Chair, Program.
Hi, family. My name is Stephanie, and I'm an addict.
Hey, Stephanie.
I was given the honor of introducing our speaker tonight, and a lot of people wonder how we get to that process of choosing a speaker. The manual says you have to have 8 years clean time, suggested. It also says that you should have a working knowledge of the 12 steps and the 12 traditions of NA. It doesn't hurt that you know how to tell your story. So when we were thinking about who we wanted to ask to lead this meeting tonight, it had to be somebody in our area who was able to talk intimately about what it was like, how it is here, and what they're doing today to stay clean one day at a time. And this guy's name came up. I've known him my entire length of recovery. And I met him at a facility that had meetings every day. Him and his twin brother were the only two guys that I knew, well, not only two, but the first two, that could recite whole passages from the basic text, and I just thought that was cool. But then when I got to know him and talk to him, I found that he was honest and caring, and he was the first man that I met in Narcotics Anonymous that showed me what a gentleman looked like. I'm very proud to introduce to you my friend, Brian Kay from Tri-County.
Hello, everybody. My name is Brian, and I'm an addict. And it feels so good to be here tonight. Before I get rolling, I'd like to thank, let's give it up for the people of Central Maryland who put on this convention, please. Thank the program committee for the honor and privilege of being selected to represent our region. I don't know about the gentleman part, anybody that knows me, but it's amazing to be here. When I got clean in 1990, when I first came to the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous, they didn't say nice things to me like, take the cotton out of your ears and stick it in your mouth. What they told me was, get real or shut the F up. These days, people say things like, not everything is for a meeting. Not everything is supposed to come out in a meeting. If that's what your sponsor's telling you, if that's what you believe, I respect that. But what I was taught, to come into a meeting and get honest and tell your story and tell all of it. And I. I certainly don't mean to offend anybody. If that's working for you, not sharing everything in the meeting, I respect that. But I think that's been the most important thing that I've done since I've got here, is that I've been willing to come to a meeting and share from my heart and share who exactly I am. It's very hard to be intimate with one person, and it's a little bit overwhelming tonight to try to be intimate with thousands of people, but I'm going to give it my best. Also, I want to thank, before I get rolling, I want to thank the people of Narcotics Anonymous who not only saved my life when I got here, but the people who stayed with me and stuck by me after I'd been here a while and I gave up on myself, and you all will understand what I'm talking about. There's just so many people. I want to thank the people from the South Potomac area, especially those from the Williams Center who taught me that recovery is about the steps of Narcotics Anonymous and living this program. I also want to thank the people from the Tri-County area. That's my new home group. My home group is called Life Support. We meet on Wednesday nights, 7:30. And I like the meeting so much, I drive an hour and a half each way to get there. It's just a powerful meeting, and it's where I feel at home. So here goes the story of Byron Kay. I grew up in Southern Maryland on a farm. I was born in 1957. I had my first drink when I was two weeks old. Back in those days, apparently when a mother couldn't make breast milk, they had to, it was suggested that they drink alcohol, and that made more milk. And so my mother drank a lot of beers and to make more milk, and my father swears I spent the first year or two of my life drunk, staggering around. Which explains a lot right there, if you know me. But I grew up as a farm boy, and at 5 years old is when I started working. I had to pick up tobacco leaves and go out and feed the chickens and feed the hogs, and I was isolated from the other kids in the neighborhood. Every day when I got off when I got home from school, I had to work, and I resented that. I resented that other kids could play baseball and play football, and I was expected and required to go to work. And another part of my story is my dad, who, by the way, today I feel is the greatest man that I've ever known in my life. But when I was a kid, he was a Prince George's County police officer. And back in the 60s, if anybody was around Prince George's County back then, what they did when they locked you up is they beat your ass, and after you got out of the hospital, then they took you to jail, and it was over. That's the way it was. That was the way it was. There was no such thing as Miranda, and you have the right to remain silent. The cops just stomped the crap. And anyway, my dad was a very hardworking man, and he taught me right from wrong. And he was very, he gave me a good upbringing. But he also when I did something wrong, he beat the living hell out of me, and I never knew when it was coming. This day and age, we call that child abuse. But back then, there was no such thing as child abuse. And I grew up in terror. One minute I would be playing catch with my dad, and he would be taking me fishing, and we'd be doing the normal things that a father and son do. And the next minute, he would just be beating the living crap out of me. And sometimes it would be in the middle of the night when I woke up. He'd be waking me up, beating the crap out of me. And I grew up confused, and I grew up sick. What I'm trying to tell y'all is I had issues way, way, way before I ever picked up my first drink or drug. I remember one time the teacher called my dad into school to discuss why I was coming to school with black eyes. And dad pulled out his badge. He said, "The way that I bring up my son is my business, and you don't want to mess with me." So I grew up stuffing feelings, and I grew up not being able to express how I felt because I knew that I was going to receive a beating. And I grew up wanting to be accepted by other people and just really feeling different and feeling weird about who I was. And I found alcohol when I was 12 years old. I got drunk the first time I drank it. And when I was 14 years old, I experimented with marijuana, went to high school, and my high school was called Gwynn Park Senior High, Brandywine, Maryland. It was the mecca of narcotics in 1973. Anything you wanted, there it was, and it was like a whole new world had opened up to me. It was peace and love and women and sex, and people had their hair long, and music, and I don't want to get anybody high in here, but I mean PCP, Quaaludes, Nembutal, 2-and-all, That's the ones I liked. I liked the ones that ended in all. And for the first time in my entire life, I felt okay a little bit with being Brian, if that makes any sense. The drugs, I use drugs not to get high, but I use drugs not to feel anything. And for a lot of people, when I was in school, drugs was just kind of a social thing. It was a pot party on Saturday night. I never could understand how you could go a day or two without getting high, because right from the jump, as soon as I got some, I wanted more. And I started rebelling against all the values that my dad and my mom had taught me, like work hard and save your money and get an education and all that stuff. I just basically dropped out of all that and decided to be a hippie. I'm from Southern Maryland, by the way. People say that down in Southern Maryland there's lots of rednecks, but really they call us freaks. And I was king freak. And I made up my mind I was going to be the best drug user that was in town. And I started a pattern of knowing who had the drugs and knowing who was looking for the drugs. And I financed my habit that way. It was like I knew who was selling what, and I knew who was looking for what. And if I'd have gotten clean when my dad and mom first tried to get me some help, I would have probably almost 35 years clean right now. Because when I was 15, they found out that I was using, and they tried to get me into a treatment program. One of those programs where you had to wear a sign around your head and stay long term, but they gave me my choice. They said you can go get some help or you can try to do this on your own. Of course, I wasn't nowhere near ready to go get some help, and I told them I would try to do better on my own. And when I was 16, I met the love of my first love of my life. I went to a party, a typical Saturday night party, and the guy that was throwing the party said that his sister had some heroin. And she lived a couple doors down. If I wanted to get some, I could go on over there with him. And I went over there and I gave her $10, and she said, "Give me your arm." And that was it. And I'll never forget the feeling of that first shot of dope. It was like, that is what I was put on this earth to do. That was what I was. Of course, that was after I threw up all over the place. But I'm one of those rare addicts, though, that really didn't develop a habit, though, for two or three years after that. I was able to use heroin just whenever it was around or whenever I could find some, but I maintained on whatever else was going on. But 18 years old, my father gave me the choice. Either you straighten up and get your shit together I just cussed. I wasn't going to cuss tonight. I'm sorry. You straighten up and get your act together or you get out the house. And I said, bye-bye. And away I went. And to make a long story short, for the next 14 years of my life, I didn't miss a day. For a long time, like I said, I was doing my hustle and making more money than I would have made working, and I was really very comfortable and very happy living the life of a junkie and shooting dope and sleeping with women and just being a big shot and being a hustler. But I got sicker, and as our literature talks about, the longer I go on with my disease and the more it progresses, the worse it gets. I started getting locked up for little petty charges like boosting or getting pulled over with a headlight out and they found drugs in the car. And I just really always thought it was just bad luck that I was having. You know? On a March night in 1990, I had gotten to the place where I was shooting 7-8 bags of dope a day, I was living in an abandoned building down on 9th and O Street in Northwest Washington. A white boy. Right across from the Giant. I had abscesses on my groin, on my arms. I had a pair of shoes, but they didn't match. I had a good blue one and a good white one for the right foot. People were looking for me. People wanted their money. My family had disowned me for years. I hadn't seen my mom and dad for several years. But that night, March 16th, 1990, the only way I know to describe it was that I was at a place that I was afraid, that I was more afraid that I was going to live one more day than die. It had gotten that bad that I thought, if I were just die, hell can't be no worse than where I'm at right now. But by the grace of God, I didn't die that night. And someone had told me about a treatment facility in up on Wisconsin Avenue where they took indigent patients. Indigent means, by the way, anybody who don't have no insurance or no money. And I called that treatment facility on March the 16th of 90, and they said, if you can get up here today, we have a couple beds, and we'll talk to you. And I went up there. All I had to my name was the clothes on my back, and I had a Marlboro cigarette behind this ear and half a Marlboro cigarette behind that ear, and I didn't have no matches. And that's where you people brought me the message of Narcotics Anonymous and told me that I would never, ever have to use again. Of course I did. We're going to get to that part of it. I got clean and up there. Every day that I went to my groups, I diarrhea, withdrawn, sick, headaches, feeling like I want to die. Thank God that I was on a locked ward. I know people in here can relate to what I'm about to share, is that I knew that I was going to die real soon, and I knew that I wanted to stop shooting dope, but I wanted them to let me out so I could just go get one more and then come back and start again, you know? Just one more just to get, you know, just to get feeling right, you know, not be sick. And they had a policy in this facility where you, if you signed yourself out, you had to wait 24 hours before you leave. And I signed myself out a couple times. But by the grace of God or whatever, I didn't leave and I stuck it out. And they gave us suggestions. They said, go to 90 meetings in 90 days when you get out of here. Get a bunch of phone numbers. Use the phone numbers. Get a sponsor. And they released me 30 days later. And on my 30-day clean, I went to a meeting in Oxon Hill, Maryland at a place called the Williams Center at a meeting called Save the Addicts, which was to become my home group. And people welcomed me there. And when I got up to get that 30-day chip and people clapped for me, I thought it was like the biggest deal that ever happened in my life. I don't know if anybody can relate, but I felt like they should close the banks and schools and have a parade for me down fucking Main Street. I said to somebody sitting next to me, how long do you got to be around here before they don't call you a newcomer no more? You know, I thought I was like an old timer with 30 days and shit, you know? So, crazier than hell, man. They thought that I had guns under my coat. I would just say, you know, I wouldn't say nothing because I knew I didn't have a clue. I knew that I needed help, and I just wouldn't say much to nobody, but people could see it in my eyes that I really wanted recovery and I really wanted to be clean. And this guy who secretaried the meeting, I'll break his anonymity, Nash G, who was my twin brother that they were talking about, a black guy about you know, he'd come up to me and say, "Hey, Brian, good to see you." And there was a lady who was the treasurer. Her name was Teresa R. I fell in love with her. I started chasing after her with 30 days clean. And any of y'all know my story, I'm still chasing after 18 years later. But it was a sense of being at home and people, and every Saturday night I had an hour and a half, and it was a beginner's step meeting, and they told us that we needed to build a foundation. And every week it was on the first step, it was on the second step, it was on the third step. And Nash was the secretary, Teresa was the treasurer, Henry was the GSR, and I was the guy that sat back in the corner looking burnt out. And any night that they couldn't get into the building because the coffee maker didn't show up with the key, I was the guy that could break into the building to make sure that the meeting went on. I couldn't figure out why we're addicts. You know, they're supposed to be drug addicts and they can't get into the building to have a meeting. You ain't going to keep me out of no building. I want something. Ain't nowhere. Never. They ain't built one. Another thing happened right in my early recovery. My mom and dad, and let me tell you a little more about that story. I'm not the kind of addict that would steal money out of my mother's purse and help her look for it like I hear in the meetings. I'm the kind of addict that would stick a double barrel 12 gauge in my mother's face and tell me, "Give me the money." My own mother, that's the way that I use, and that's the real deal. But anyway, when I got clean, my mom and dad came up to the treatment center, and I guess they called them from the treatment. I hadn't talked to them for a couple years, and they said, "Son, if you want to come back home and you really want some help, you're welcome to come back home." And when I got out of that treatment center, my dad had bought me an old used Chevrolet pickup truck that was held together by coat hangers and stuff, and he said, You can drive this back and forth to your meetings if that's what you're going to do. There is no greater love for anybody than a mother and father has for their children. Thank God for mom and dad. Thank God for mom and dad. And so that's all I could do for my first year. I mean, I hadn't been employed ever in my life. And all I knew to do was shoot dope. So they told me in treatment, "You've got to chase your recovery, Brian, just as hard as you chase the dope." And that's all I did, was go to meetings every day. They say 90 and 90. I went to about 150 meetings in my first 90 days and started meeting people. And you know, at first, my disease was telling me I didn't belong in here. Y'all had teeth and you're driving nice cars and you own your own homes, and I thought, you know, you're a bunch of lightweights and stuff, and I felt like I really didn't belong here, but I didn't have nowhere else to go, and you know, I'm going to give this a chance. I'm just going to give it a chance. And another thing, let me tell you about South Potomac. You better be about the steps when you're up in South Potomac. It's where I got clean. And every meeting that I went to up there, they were talking about the steps. And in the steps, God is in the steps an awful lot. And it seemed like every meeting I went to, it was by the grace of God. And God is wonderful. And God has done so much in my life. And God, God, God. And I had a resentment toward God. I really didn't even know who God was. But I figured if there was a God, how could somebody let me go through all that I'd been through? And all that, and it really kind of made me mad to hear everybody talk about God so much in the meetings. And I remember one night, with about 2 or 3 months clean, It was one of those meetings where the speaker, who had 5 years, and back then 5 years was like as much time was around, he was talking about how great God was and how powerful the third step was in his life. And then they opened the meeting up and everybody was sharing about God and how great God was. And I was getting madder and madder and madder. I was sitting in the corner of the room just boiling. And the man made the mistake of calling on me. He pointed at me and said, "Sir, looks like you'd like to share." And I said, "I'm Brian and I'm an addict. And fuck you, fuck God, fuck all this bullshit. Fuck you." And I meant it. And everybody in the room said, "Keep coming back, Brian." That's the first, and the guy that led the meeting came up to me after the meeting and said, "Man, you shared powerful, man. That was strong. That was real, man. That was honest, man. He said, if you say honest, that will keep you clean." And I found out something, man. That's the first time anybody said I'd done something good in a long time. And I also found out you can't get thrown out of this place no matter what you do. There must be something to it. So on my journey of recovery I went, and boy, it's a wonderful topic. I was looking at the program, I think it's sometime later tonight. It's you can't solve a spiritual problem with a physical solution. That's my story right there, you know. I couldn't wait to get a year so I could get in a relationship. You know, they said don't get in one for a year, but you know, and I remember going to my sponsor with about 4 months clean. I thought really that's what I needed in my life. If I were to get in a relationship and have me a girlfriend and we could go to meetings and we could study our steps and have sex, and you know, my life would be complete. Like I had a lot to offer. I'm living at home and I'm driving an old raggedy pickup truck and not even working. I was, you know, every woman's dream. And so my sponsor told me, he said, "You want to be in a relationship? Here, let me tell you what you need to do." He said, "You get to the meeting early, like 15 minutes early, and you go to the bathroom before the meeting, and you get your coffee before the meeting, and get your ashtray." Back then you could smoke in the meeting. "Get your ashtray, get all that before the meeting, and sit down in the front row and get in a relationship with your ass in that chair." And let's see if you can go an hour and a half without breaking up. And if you watch me today, that's still what I do when I go to a meeting. I get there a little bit early and I sit down in my chair and I make sure I go the entire time of the meeting without breaking up my ass in that chair. And it's been one of the healthiest relationships I've had in my recovery. You never know who's going to say what I need to hear to save my life for that day. You know what I'm saying? So anyway, my sponsor, after about a year clean and all that, he said, "What do you want to do with the rest of your life? This ain't just about going to meetings. This is about living life on life's terms. This is about becoming employable." And I said, "You know, I think I want to be a counselor. I think that would be a noble thing to do." And so be it, God had me counseling a couple months later. I'm working in a treatment facility with 13 months clean. I'm going to work with a suit and tie on, going to staff meetings, and man, recovery had just done so much for my life in such a brief amount of time. And And I worked with adolescents, and I really enjoyed it. But the honest truth is, I hadn't dealt with a whole lot of things and issues and all that stuff that was there way before I ever picked up. And I really was not an appropriate candidate to, looking back at it, I was not an appropriate candidate to do that kind of work. But I thought I was at the time, and I enjoyed taking people to meetings. And I worked there for a couple years almost. And one Sunday night, a young lady came into the treatment facility. She was 17 years old, and she looked like Kelly Bundy on Married with Children. She was just gorgeous, 17 years old, and I, thought she was right pretty. And she started coming on to me the first night that she came in there. I mean, making all kinds of suggestions of what she wanted to do and this and that. And I was telling my sponsor about it and told him I had it all under control, but I wasn't being honest because I didn't have it under control. And with almost 3 years clean at that time, one Saturday night, it was time to take the clients to a meeting, and I went into her room to get her to go to a meeting, this young lady. And I sat down on the bed to talk to her, and she proceeded to do something inappropriate with me. I'll just leave it at that. I'll keep this R-rated. I'm the counselor, she's the client. I'm the adult, she's the adolescent. Within a half an hour, I left the place, and within an hour, I was shooting dope. With almost 3 years clean. And I was suicidal. I wanted to die. I was talking to somebody last night. The Japanese have a term called hara kiri, where if you do something dishonorable, the only way that you can make amends for it is to kill yourself. And I went and shot some dope that night, and I came back, and I called my sponsor and told him what had happened, and told him I'd shot dope, and I told him that I was going to die that night, and I appreciated everything that everybody had done. Good news is I'm an addict, because I got that shot of dope in me. I had to go back and get one more before, because it was good dope. And during that time that I left Southern Maryland and went back up to D.C. to cop, my sponsor and some other men in this program came to my house and removed all the guns out of my house. They said, you're not going to die tonight. And I went back the next day into a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous and got a white chip. It's a weird feeling. Anybody had never had that? It's a beautiful thing, but it's a weird feeling to have almost 3 years clean and then have people clap for you for picking up a white chip. It's just the unconditional love that goes on in here. And my network and my attorney, and I was going through all that, they told me it really wasn't all that, and it's kind of your word against somebody else's word, and they don't have no case. But this program taught me that I have to practice these principles in all my affairs. And I knew what I had done, and God knew what I had done, and I had to go atone for that. And I stood up in front of a judge, and I said, Judge, that's what they pay you to do. You tell them, you. Oh, and by the way, in the 8 months, I shot dope just about every day again, but I came to meetings just about every day. I left that out. I know what it's like to cut dope on top of the basic text of Narcotics Anonymous. But I stood up in front of that judge, and I said, it's your job to do, and he gave me a little bit over a year. And my plan was I was going to do my year, and then when I got out of jail, I was going to go ahead and kill myself. There's no point going on the way that I had shamed myself and it shamed you people. And funny thing happened. Every day when I was in that jail, every day, when they called mail call, there were 7, 10 letters from people in Narcotics Anonymous. People wrote me letters longer than their fourth step. We ain't giving up on you. We are not giving up on you. They write me from my home group.